Welcome to Barnyard Language, honest talk about running farms and raising families. We are Katie and Arlene, an Iowa sheep farmer and an Ontario dairy farmer, with six kids, two husbands, and a whole lot of chaos between us.
While this is a podcast for farm families, sometimes our content isn't for the whole family. So kick off your boots, reheat your coffee, and join us for some Barnyard Language.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Barnyard Language. We're on lamb watch in Iowa, right, Kitty? Are there lambs? Where are the lambs? How many lambs?
There are no lambs.
Oh, no.
There are still no lambs. My calendar said they should have started March 1st. Jim's calendar somehow says March 13th. Today is March 5th.
Oh, dear.
This happens every year. It has been 15 years that I've had sheep, and for 15 years, every lambing season, I have decided that this is probably the year that there will just be no lambs, despite the fact that the girls are all huge, they're all bagging up, they're all very obviously close to lambing. But every year we get to that point where we're like, they're going to explode if those lambs don't come out. This is going to be the year that one of these sheep actually explodes.
They cannot get any bigger. And then they do.
I don't know how they do it. They're very stretchy animals. But no, no lambs yet. Which is fine because I am still halfway through setting up the lamb cam system. So if any of our listeners have some deep networking knowledge they want to share with me, let me know. That'd be great.
So currently the lamb cam is you walking out there cursing at the camera that doesn't work and coming back in the house because there are still no lambs.
Yeah, basically. It's very sad. Also, the other day, I've had this happen with cattle before, but as anyone with livestock has probably witnessed by now, I went out and we have a ram in a pen and I see all the ewes are standing around. You know, it's dark out. It's like 4 o'clock in the morning, right? And I see all the ewes standing there staring at this big white thing stretched out on the pavement in a lot. And I turn on the flashlight and it's the ram and his head's back. His legs are out at weird angles. He's like slowly flailing around. I'm assuming he's got bloat again. He's an old guy. You know, I check for lambs real quick and I go back in the house. You know, I'm heading back towards the house thinking about, you know, I'm checking lambs about like, do I just get the 22? Do I call the vet? Is it worth calling the vet because he's already had this happen before and he's old? And if he's this sick, he's going to be dead before she gets here. And, you know, emergency vet calls are expensive. They don't make you any friends, blah, blah, blah. And I'm in the sheep barn thinking about all this. And I hear Bailey, the Australian Shepherd, give that, like, I am not fucking around bark. You know, where dogs have that bark that's like, you know, and they're having fun. And then there's that, like, I will mom voice you, bark. And I walk back out and the ram is standing there perfectly healthy because apparently that fucker was just sleeping funny and was just like, I don't know, sheep dreaming with his little legs kicking or whatever. I don't know. So I almost
totally fine
shot and or called the vet on an animal that was perfectly healthy.
Perfectly fine.
We've had cows do this before. We had a cow that would do this. Like, you would climb over the fence and get right up to her, and then she'd sit up and be like, what?
This is just how I sleep, ma'am.
I can't deal with this level of fuckery. I just can't.
Not now, dude. She needs to be distracted by lambs.
And my kids gave me viral pink eye.
That is a whole gift right there.
And that is also a whole level of fuckery. And
both eyes?
It's a whole gift. Both eyes. It's a look. It's a look. How are things at your place, Arlene?
Oh, things are fine. We are currently in baby Jersey watch with the single Jersey cow is ready to calve any day now. So not quite the same as lamb watch, but similar levels of excitement, I'm sure. So a new little Jersey baby will be arriving sometime soon-ish. What else is going on here?
So is this your daughter's spiritual soulmate cow?
Yes. So Peach, the former 4-H calf, yes, is about to have her second baby. So then our Jersey herd will be up to three, assuming it is healthy and sticks around.
How often is she contacting you? Does she have a camera mounted just right above the cow or like?
No, she actually doesn't have a camera in the barn. I think when it comes to cow stuff, she's more frequently in touch with my husband. So I'll have to check in with him and see how often he's getting contacted. But
I'll message her and suggest adding a camera.
Yeah, that's right.
That'll really liven things up, I bet. How's Saturn doing? Did she go away yet?
Saturn did go, yes. Yep. She did not get in calf, and she was not making any more friends in the barn by continuing to try and hurt us. So, yes, she did. She did make her way on a truck to somewhere else. So, goodbye, Saturn. And my favorite cow, Sugar, is a delight. She is very affectionate and likes lots of pets. So, she is my much more favorite cow than Saturn is. What else is going on the farm?
Do you keep a ranked list, like, written down in a barn?
No, I only have a couple of favorites. I don't tend to like to talk about the weather because, I mean, farmers always want to talk about the weather, but it is so hot. I mean, not like summertime hot, but it is unusually hot here. And last night when I was milking, like yesterday afternoon, I was like, had to take my coveralls off. I have clothes underneath, don't worry. I usually layer in the barn. But the coveralls had to go because it was just so hot. And I mean, it's been the strangest winter. We had so little snow, so little cold weather. Anyone who snowmobiles, not me, but we do have snowmobile trails on our property. I think they had like maybe 5 or 6 days where they could actually be out because there was like it just wasn't cold. So weird.
I think they got maybe 12 hours of snowmobiling
in our
place this year.
Yeah.
it was bad.
Hope you enjoyed your trail pass. That really paid off. Yes, I think it's more of a four-wheeler situation these days than much of a snowmobile situation. And there's a small town near us that they put a big speed skating oval out on the lake and have the last few years have tried to do speed skating competitions. Well, actually, it's been like 20 years. And for a lot of years, it went really well. And there was always a weekend in February where they had this big speed skating race. And then last year, it never opened or only for a few days. They had to keep canceling it. So this year, they're just going to do pop-ups. So it wasn't a set weekend, but it was like whenever they got it ready, just show up and skate. And they never even got it open at all, just because February was, I think, the hottest on record. So climate change seems to be a thing.
I know being close to the Mississippi, we have a fair number of ice fishing outfitters, and their business is not going well. Because the Mississippi also flows fast enough.
It's got to be pretty cold to, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not great.
Yes. There were some people out ice fishing that I have seen this season. And even on a really cold year, I don't like the idea of ice fishing. But especially this year, it's just terrifying to me. And then, I mean, you hear about the people that go through the ice and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. That is one of my fears right there. Going through ice. So I will not be an ice fishing person unless I can like stand on the shore and someone else can put a hole out there for me and I can like aim for it maybe. But no, I don't think so. I will avoid that particular pastime for sure.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Well, should we go ahead and introduce our guest for this week?
I think we might as well.
Before we introduce our guest for this week, Katie, I just wanted to do a little, we don't do this very often, but give a warning to our listeners that we're going to talk about death by suicide. And obviously that is a heavy topic and not one that everyone is prepared to consume as a podcast. So I just want people to know that that's something that's going to be discussed with our guest for this week. And if you're in a place to listen to it, she is the mother of someone who died by suicide and has really turned that into an amazing mission. And community has come out of that, but that doesn't mean that it's not a heavy topic as well. So if you are listening and this is where you need to stop, that's okay. Take care of yourself. And if not, I hope you enjoy our interview. Diane, we start each of our interviews with the same question, and this is a way to introduce yourself. So we always ask, what are you growing? So for our farmers, that's usually crops and livestock and sometimes kids, but can also be businesses and careers and charities and all kinds of other stuff. So Diane, what are you growing?
Well, we're growing in our fields. We are growing corn and soybeans and wheat and a rotation. And we have a barn full of pigs that are finishing hogs. And we grow hope. Hope in our family, hope in our community, and hope at Three Oaks Cabin.
Those are a lot of good things. So I'm guessing that you also have some children who maybe aren't in your house anymore, but can you give me a count on those too? Because I know that you're also a parent.
We have 7 children, 5 boys and 2 girls. One son lives in heaven, and the other 5 of whom are married, and one of them is still single, looking for a very lovely farm lady to join him on the farm. We've got 2 grandchildren who we've had for the last week. We just brought them back last night. And yeah, that pretty much sums up our family. Everybody lives nice and close. All our children are involved in agriculture at some level. We're hoping that our 2 sons who live the closest in proximity will take over the farm now with our big change in our farming. But yeah, everybody lives very much within coffee distance. So that's good.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. It's easy for me to think that, you know, like that my family is complete at this point, but you know, like it sounds like yours, you know, you get to a stage where then it starts to grow all over again in different ways and bring in new people through marriage and grandbabies and all that kind of stuff.
And that's lovely too, to see who they bring home.
Yeah, that's right.
I like that measuring unit of coffee distance. That's good about, like, you know, I assume you said coffee distance. If that's not what you said, then.
Yeah.
Yes, I did say that. We're born, raised Dutch people. We live on coffee. And it feels like you can drop what you're doing and be there within an hour and if one of the kids needs you. So that's my measuring stick.
And then when you said that you've had the grandkids for 2 weeks, do you mean at your home for 2 weeks or they have been part of your family for 2 weeks?
No, they were at our home. Their parents were away on holidays. So yeah, we got to do grandma, grandpa duty.
And how old are they?
They're a 5-year-old boy and a 2-year-old girl. Yeah, very lively kids. But I love that. I'd much rather steer energy than try and create it. So
that's a great way of looking at it.
I'll remember that to tell to my 5-year-old son's teacher today when we have an appointment about his
energy.
5-year-oldness. Yes. Yes, he is very 5. it's a lot of 5. So Diane, where did you grow up and what is your background?
Yeah, I was born in Holland on a dairy farm. And when I was 9, we immigrated to Canada. And my parents bought a farm about 2 miles down the road from where we live now. And where we live now is where Al grew up. So I always kind of jokingly say that he was the cheap Dutchman who didn't want to go any farther than 2 miles to find a girlfriend. But we grew up both on family farms. I grew up on a pig farm and his dad did mostly cash crop. He had some pigs, but not full time. His dad also had a trucking company. We both have the ag background and we have it, I guess, in our genes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you gave us a short bio before this interview and you mentioned that you spent some time in military life. So where did that fit into kind of the timeline of your family?
When Al finished high school, he had the opportunity to do, it's called the ROTP program, where you go to a regular university and you are actually part of the military already. You're a member of the military family and they put you through school and then you owe them 5 years afterward of service. So he did that. He went to Western. And when he was done that, like in the 80s, there was not a good opportunity to start farming with the interest rates the way they were. So we decided to do that first. And it was an honor and a great privilege to serve our country in that way. We're very aware of the blessing of being a Canadian and to embrace Canadian culture and to share that culture, I guess, across the world. We're mostly Al. I didn't get to go very often, but to share that blessing of our Canadianness with other people across the world and to live out a little bit of our patriotism with active service.
Yeah. So were you then moved around as a family, or did he go away and then you kind of stayed put, or what did that look like for your family in those years?
We got bumped around. We did 3-year stints mostly. And I think that was part of our decision finally to leave the military. By that time we had 4 children, or almost 4 children, and to uproot them every 3 years when they have just settled into a school, found their new group of friends, and to say, okay, now we're moving again and you have to do this all over again. With the character of some of our children, we felt that wouldn't be a good fit for them, that it would not stretch them, it might break them. And so that was a big part of our decision to leave the military and to, yeah, once the farm came up for sale between our parents. So my mom and dad lived 2 miles apart from Al's mom and dad, and the farm in the middle came up for sale. So it had our name written all over it. The military at the time was trying to retire some of their navigators, which was Al's role in the military. And so, yeah, the timing was just, it was a God thing that everything just fell into place. And he was ready to leave the military as much as he enjoyed it. He loved the camaraderie, the closeness, the brotherhood there. But he was ready to take on the next chapter and go back to the farm. And that was always been a dream and a goal, I guess. We both kind of knew that eventually we would hopefully go back to the farm.
So, Diane, with your husband being a professional navigator, what was he navigating? Planes, boats?
Airplanes, actually. That plane, mostly. the Hercules, yeah. So the transport plane. But he did the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And, yeah, brought lots of ammunition and taught for 3 years as well in the military.
So, yeah. So I know there's a real stereotype that men never ask for directions. If your husband is a professional navigator, will he ask for directions, or does he not need them? Or will he just refuse to ask for them even if he does need them?
He will always go back to, I know where the sun is, so I know which direction I'm going in. I'll get there. Thank you very much. I don't need the interaction with the other human to tell me where I have to go.
That checks out.
It might be more of a gender thing than a occupation thing. No, maybe. I don't know.
I have to say, as someone who moved, I grew up in central Iowa where everything's platted, you know, in square miles. So if you turn left enough times, you're going to end up right where you started. And I moved to a part of Iowa where there's a lot of hills and trees and cliffs and rivers. And I still get lost all the time up here because, yeah, I'm from a place where, A, it's flat enough. You can probably see where you're going from where you started. And if you can see the sun, you can just turn either left or right and you'll get there. We're up here, you know, if you turn left too many times, you're going to end up in the Mississippi River or something.
So then you said when you were leaving the military, you had 4 kids and you were coming back home. What was that transition for you as a couple and for your kids? I mean, it was always your dream, but what was that time like when you were actually going back to farm life and the reality of being on the farm versus the dream of being on the farm?
I think it was a lot of different aspects. It was exciting because it was our longtime dream, but it was also intimidating because you no longer have the government paycheck, right? You're going from, and many people strongly dissuaded us from leaving the military and the what they called the cushy job and the security of being employed by the government to being on your own. And that part was a big switch, right? The security of having a paycheck to now we have to do this. And I remember distinctly both of us sitting there the first time when we bought the farm on paper and we went home and went, now we have to do this, right? The ink is drying and now this is real. And it was intimidating, but at the same time, it was great because we had the support of both of our parents as far as equipment. We didn't have to purchase everything right away. They were very supportive, both of them. And that transition went as well as it could have. But yeah, there was intimidating moments where all of a sudden you have to go, now we're in the driver's seat of a totally different way of life. And there's nobody going to tell us what to do anymore. We have to figure it out, and we have to set our own agendas and our own schedules and our own routines in order to, accomplish everything that needs to be accomplished seasonally and annually.
Yeah, that's right.
Diane, did you find that experience to be really similar to the experience of bringing your first baby into the world as well?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like a lot of what you're saying is a lot of what bringing that first kid home from the hospital felt like. Like, nobody's in charge.
Yep. Or your first mortgage. Yeah, it's exciting, exhilarating, and hard, and intimidating, and really humbling, right? Like, we don't have control over our future to a large degree. And especially in farming, I think that gets driven home quite regularly and quite vividly, is that as farmers, we're dependent on the weather, and my husband likes to say everybody's dependent on God for everything, but in farming, there's no middleman, right? If it doesn't rain, it's directly God related. So I like that phrase, and it is a very humbling experience to start. And I think every season is humbling.
Do you remember how your kids did during that period? Did they thrive being on the farm, or were there challenges for them too, getting used to, you know, it's one thing to go home and visit the grandparents, the omas and the opas, but to be there full time. I mean, I probably, like you said, the stability was probably reassuring for some of them, but that there might have been challenges along the way with them too.
I think we always came back. Like, we spent all our holidays, military holidays, on the farm. We came back for 3 weeks in the spring and 3 weeks in the fall from wherever we were to help plant the crop and take it off. So our kids had a lot of exposure that way, but it was a switch, of course, going from town living to country living, but they embraced it in a big way. We did have some big high-level discussions with them about safety. I used many fluorescent color aerosol cans and made lines on the laneway and around the shop and around the barn, and made a very visible boundary. This is where you're allowed to be. This is a learning thing for you and I, but I need to be able to see you, and for your safety, this is the line. And you don't want to find out what happens when you go past that line. And there were one or two times, but we drove a message home. And yeah, that whole idea of safety, and that there is no, the safety rules need to be listened to and respected, because there's no recourse. You can't undo horrific accidents. So yeah, we spent time, you know, putting bales of hay or straw on a PTO, trying to show them the gravity of what we were saying and giving it some visual reinforcement. So yeah, I think the safety part was a big thing, and that there was no, with some rules, there are no yeah buts. It's this is how it is, and you must listen to them.
Yeah, that's really important stuff. And living where you're working, you know, is hard when you, at any age, right? You know, to get them used to the fact that, yes, you know, like, this is your home, but this is also a work site, and we need to be careful and aware of our surroundings in a way that maybe is a little bit different. I mean, in town, you've also got to be aware, obviously, of not crossing streets with cars and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, it's just a different environment for sure.
And to gently place age-appropriate responsibility on them for that safety.
Yes, for sure.
When it seems like too, you know, especially with larger tractors and things, just kids learning about how much longer it can take to stop or to turn, or, you know, even just to react with the weight and the way tractors and things are built, that it's not, they're a lot bigger and a lot slower to respond than, you know, or a car or bicycle or something.
Mm-hmm. And just because you can see the tractor doesn't mean the driver can see you, right? Because depending on the sight line, there's lots of things that can get in the way.
So as someone who's, tell us how we deal with our little kids. My kids are 5 and 7, and you've raised a lot more kids than I have, and sounds like pretty successfully. So please tell us what to do, or tell me at least. I don't care if nobody else listens, but.
No, not from day one. But yeah, do you have any advice that kind of, if someone's asking, I'm assuming you're not someone who's going to dole out advice to everybody on the street, but if someone was asking for parenting advice from your stage of life, do you have anything that that sticks out to you?
Yes, I think to parent in the moment, that our children feel without idolizing our children, because I think that is a major pitfall as well, that we somehow live vicariously in our children, but that our children feel secure in our devotion to them. And I guess that means that in our day-to-day working and walking with them, that they will always be confident that no matter how busy the farm is, no matter how busy anything else is, that we will drop whatever we're doing if they need us. And that their heart feels listened to and feels entrusted with us, because it's the building blocks that you place when they're young that you can tap into when they're older, when you might have to have hard discussions or difficult topics to broach. If we don't have their undivided trust that you have their best interest at heart, then to me, you're missing a lot of the foundation that you need as a parent of a teenager or, you know, an adolescent or even adult children, that they feel loved and respected and trusted with your investment of your heart in their life. I think that's the biggest thing. And it doesn't mean spoiling them. It doesn't mean we're attentive to only them all the time, but somehow to convey that trust that you have to create. And I think that's, as a parent, it's our job to create that. And then to treasure each moment and each season in your children's life. Like right now, your 5-year-old is super energetic and they never stop talking and they have so many questions, and it can be exhausting. It can be so exhausting. But it passes. And then when they're 9 and 10 and they don't tell you everything anymore, it's like, oh, you know what? They don't come for cuddles anymore. They don't come for, then there's something else to embrace. But I think to embrace each season as your children grow up and to treasure them, because it goes by so fast. And I think as a parent to recall it and always remember that our job is to prepare them to leave, which is a really, really hard concept as a parent, right? Because we want to keep them around. We want to, you know, tuck them under our wing, and we want to, but our job is to prepare them for their own life in the world. And that, I guess that prevents us from living vicariously in our children. That we learn, teach them to stand on their own 2 feet, that we need to teach them to think for themselves, to not just accept anything that other people say, to evaluate for themselves. But our job is to prepare them to leave. And I found that very hard as a parent, because I do like to fix everything. My natural inclination is, so let me fix that for you, rather than here, let me help you fix it for yourself, right? So, and I think that puts perspective on the teaching moments that present themselves in day-to-day life, if we have a long-term perspective.
Well, I think part of the issue we're getting into now too is that, yeah, with the teaching kids to use their own logic and solve their own problems and to question things, they keep questioning me about stuff too. I'm like, you know, when I said to not just blindly listen to things, I didn't mean me.
Yeah.
Blindly follow what I tell you.
Yeah, that's right. Some of the most important lessons we're teaching them make it harder for us to be parents. But yeah, that's the important stuff too. Those are some really good things to remember, Diane. Thank you so much for those.
But I think obeying and self-evaluation or evaluating are two different things, right? And I think those are also important distinguishing marks. As a parent, our role is to teach them obedience, but not at all cost with the evaluation aspect.
So what did you enjoy most about raising kids on the farm and now having grandkids kind of in the same environment? What's the best part about having farm kids?
I think that would definitely be to teach them the beauty and the beauty of life, of creation, that life is a gift and we have to live that way. We have to treat it that way. We have to treat each other that way, because everybody has been given that gift of life and that fills us with respect for their life. I think the opportunity to teach kids about the fragility of life, right? Like if there's some eggs in the nest that don't hatch, well, why not? And that not everything always turns out the way you expected, and some things are just hard. Teaching about life and death on the farm, I think it just has a very, very tender way of teaching harsh realities, that life is sometimes very black and white. So yeah, opportunity to teach those life lessons and to teach them the beauty of getting your feet and your hands dirty, of real work and the sense of accomplishment. Whereas I always picture if you raise a family in town, you almost have to invent worthwhile work. Where on the farm, it just presents itself and they are accomplishing real things with, you know, sweeping the aisle in the barn or even taking down cobwebs in the barn or feeding animals. It's real work. It makes a real tangible difference in the lives of creatures. And I think those are important lessons.
Yeah, the immediacy of the results too. I mean, like definitely if I sweep in my house, I can see the difference. But, you know, you sweep up an area in the barn or, you know, you do a task somewhere and you can see the results of your work really, really quickly, right? You know, that animal got fed, that area got cleaned, those buckets got moved, you know, like and there's also room for, I like the fact that there's, in most cases, not in the safety aspect, but in a lot of cases, there's room for error, right? If the chicken's feed gets knocked on the ground in a slightly different place, they're still going to go over and eat it. Whereas, you know, if dinner gets dropped on the floor somewhere else, you might not be able to salvage that. But yeah, animals are a bit more forgiving when it comes to the of their living conditions, I guess we'll say.
Yeah, and the flip side of that is the animal does depend on them to follow through on their chores or on their responsibilities. So if I don't do my work, something suffered. And I think, yeah, those are very important lessons for kids to live.
Yeah, that's right.
I think, too, it can teach such good lessons, especially with livestock, about doing things because it's the right thing to do and not because we're expecting something in return. You know, that the cow is not going to buy you a new toy because you fed her. You know, she's going to not die because you fed her. Like, you know, we're doing it because that's what we do.
And I think in our society, that is a very prevalent notion that if I do something, especially as a child, that there should be something in return. And it's like, well, no, the sense of accomplishment, that is your reward.
Yeah, that's right. Podcasts are free to listen to, but they aren't free to create. Katie and I would appreciate your support as we work to build the Barnyard Language community.
Patreon is an easy way for you to make a contribution that goes directly to making the show. As a member of our Patreon community, you get to watch the video version of our weekly updates, complete with questionable hairstyles and clutter. With three levels of support, you can choose a tier that works for you.
Keep the podcast going by becoming a patron today at patreon.com/barnyardlanguage. When it comes to raising kids on the farm, what were some of your struggles back when they were little ones and you were starting out, or as you expanded your family when you were living on the farm? What did you struggle with when you had little ones and farm life?
I think juggling all the things I had to get done. When we moved back to the farm, we had almost four children. I think Jordan was born 3 weeks after we moved. And I took my job, like there was no way I could find a job that would pay off the farm. So my job on the farm was to save money. And I took my job in the home saving money very seriously. So it took, that took a lot of time and energy. I think though, the biggest thing that I struggled with was, where do I have to be? We were a long time in the sandwich generation where our parents needed us as much as our children did. And that sense of guilt, if I was with my family, then what does one of the parents need you, the in-laws or my own parents? And if you're with the parents, you're thinking, should I be at home with the children right now? So you never have that feeling of, I'm doing the right thing right now. Or no, I shouldn't say that. I fought with that feeling of some level of guilt, no matter where I was, because it wasn't enough hours to do everything well, or at least not the way I would have liked to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So one of the reasons...
And I think also making room for my marriage, to have time. That was one of my biggest regrets, is that when our life was busy, busy with young children, is that I didn't make time to spend with Al.
Yeah. And when you're already feeling pulled in so many directions, it's easy for the marriage relationship to be the one that's the easiest to put off, or, you know, we'll do that another time, or we'll go out together next week. We'll take that vacation next year. Yeah. Those things can really easily get pushed off when everyone else is demanding your time and attention. So one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you today was to talk about the Three Oaks Cabin, but we also were hoping that you would be willing to tell us about your son, Dallas. So you mentioned at the beginning that you have one child who isn't here on earth with us anymore. Can you tell us who he was, what he was like, what did he enjoy?
Well, his nickname was Whippersnapper. And I think that sums him up very well. He was three when we moved to the farm. And he was like born to farm. He was in the shop, in the barn, as soon as he was allowed to. And every opportunity he got to tag along with the men, rather than being stuck in the house with mom, was his thing. When he was six, he bought 12 chickens or 12 hens and started selling eggs. He dragged them to church. He dragged them everywhere he went and sold eggs. And yeah, he increased his flock. But on his 18th birthday, he bought his first farm with his own money. And that was just because he had that sense of business in him. Everything was a building block. Okay, now I have enough for this, so now I will invest it into that. And then he would resell things. And yeah, he was known as Mr. Kijiji in the area here, because he always found deals, always saw things behind people's barns and or in the weeds, and he would, you know, stop in, how much do you want for that, and resell it 2 days later for double the money. And so, yeah, he was a very entrepreneurial young man, very much so. He was fiercely loyal to his wife, his family, his church family, his fire department. And he was maybe hardworking to a fault. And we would be remiss if we didn't mention how funny he was. We still have a lot of Dallas sayings in the house. And once somebody would, you know, say, oh, that was one of his sayings. And if someone else would say it, it just wouldn't be funny. But if he said it, it was just funny. He was always, yeah, always had something that would make people smile. And a very caring, always had made time. I think one of the things that sums it up super well is when shortly after he passed away, the fire chief came and said, the fire chief himself had lost his wife 3 months before Dallas passed away. And so that was August of 2020. And the chief was in the backfield rolling hay or turning hay. He says, I just needed time alone. I needed space and just to have some quiet time. So I was turning hay in the backfield and I saw this black Dodge pickup come barreling down the gravel road. And he says, if trucks could screech to a halt on a gravel road, that's what he would have done. He says, all of a sudden the cloud of dust stopped and I see him get out. He could run like the wind. He just kind of skittered across the field. He says, he didn't say a word. He just climbed on the tractor, gave me a bear hug, gave me a tap on the shoulder and off he went. He didn't say a word. He says, but it changed my whole day. And that sums Dallas up. He didn't have that much earthly goods to share, but what he had, he shared, and his heart was one of the things he shared.
Diane, I just want to say what a wonderful gift it is when you hear about someone and really wish that you had gotten a chance to meet them, because he sounds like he was a hell of a guy, and you know, that's
you what that sums him up. He was a hell of a guy. And everywhere you go, like we've got a stack of cards almost 2 feet high of high school students or their parents. You know, like Dallas was the guy that took my son under his wing when he came to grade 9 and Dallas was in grade 12. And, you know, my son was this or this and Dallas cheered him up. And yeah, everywhere. He was just the pick-me-up guy.
So I guess this goes to the question, where did the idea for Three Oaks Cabin come from and why did this great project come about?
Well, sometime back before that, I had been seeing a counselor and the one time I said to her, I just want space. I want a quiet spot where I can sort this out in my head. Is there any, like, is there a retreat somewhere where I could go for a weekend or a week and sort all this stuff out in my head? And then she said, no, unfortunately, I don't know of anything. But if you ever find out or hear about anything, let me know, because I have so many clients who would love that space to have a time out, right? A time out for myself. And so that kind of is where the idea came from. And then when we lost Dallas, we had been expanding very aggressively the 3 years leading up to it. He had built a brand new finishing barn, and then we did right after, and we had our first batch of pigs in the barn when he passed away. He had bought land, we had bought land with the idea that, you know, over time he was going to take over. But when he passed away, we had 8,000 pigs at the time on feed. There was no way Al and I could do that with two of us. We were hard pressed to do it with the three of us. And the other boys were not interested in full-time farming, certainly not pig farming. So we had to make some very immediate, drastic changes in order to survive emotionally and, financially too. We couldn't make it all work. So with the farm, we had to sell farms, and some of the money that came in didn't feel right to, I don't know, we had to find a purpose for it. And one of them was life insurance policy. And it didn't feel right to put that in the big pot. So we kind of came up with the idea of, let's create this place where people can take a rest. And it won't be a legacy about him, because it's not about Dallas. It's about the people we want to help. But maybe his legacy of generous living, yes. It will keep that alive, and but it keeps giving.
Yeah. So can you describe what stage you're at right now? Is there a physical space at this point? Are there programs being offered, or where are you in the, I know these ideas, the time from idea to actual, you know, completion or when programs are running is sometimes not as quick as any of us would like, but what stage are you at right now and what's happening on the ground?
We are dotting our I's and crossing our T's, and that ink is kind of drying. That's how far we are. We started, I'm going to say 2 weeks in, that we had made a commitment as a family. This tragedy will not define us. Hope will define us, and we need to do something, especially once we found out the statistics. It took 2 years to get our building permit. So January 4th of last year, we poured concrete, and the structure is all but finished. We're waiting for Enbridge to hook up our gas and the printed material to go with the programming for guests while they're at the cabin is being printed, and the video modules are being tweaked. So yeah, and the website is being updated. I met with him yesterday, and he is going to update with the booking process on the website. And then we are ready to roll. So we're hoping by March 15th, we have our first guests. And it's actually very exciting because Dallas had a cousin who was a best friend and some of his very close high school friends who were also pallbearers, but they had a really close-knit group of about 6 or 8 people, like 4 couples. And so we're getting them to go through the whole booking process once it's online. And they will be our first guests, and they're going to stay there together and go through the process of booking and then give us feedback on, you know, this needs changing or that needs tweaking. We thought that would be a very nice way to, I don't know, open the cabin.
Yeah, that's right. So what does it look like if someone were to walk in the door? I mean, what are we talking in terms of space and bedrooms and that type of thing? Just so, because we're only audio, what would people see if they drove in the driveway?
Well, it's a 3-bedroom log home. It's square timbers. Yeah, when you walk in, it's that raw wood smell. And we find it very grounding. It's all organic material, like as in like earthy material. All the colors are kind of earth tones. Lots of raw, like bamboo and raw wood material, so that people feel connected with nature. It's got a fully stocked kitchen. It's got laundry facilities. It has internet. 3 bedrooms, so it can accommodate a family of 6. And in the upper level, there's also we call it a common area or a multi-purpose area, where we hope to host workshops or give it the space available to do workshops. So if a fire department or a therapist has people that they want to work through a certain program or a day course or something, that they could use that space and just a different scenery and again, have the grounding aspect of being in nature, that it would be rewarding and effective for therapy. And then the trails in the woodlot have been placed this week. We still have to top dress them, but they are available now. Still a little muddy, but our goal is to have them top dressed and either with gravel or with wood chips, so that people can use nature for healing.
Sure. And so who would be your guests? Who do you think is going to be coming, or who is the cabin accessible to?
We're hoping to host farmers and first responders who are in need of or who ought to take a break and reevaluate and reorient to what they believe is important in their life. Because sometimes when we're in the frazzle of life, say for farmers, when we're always busy, we always have way more things to do in a day than we can possibly get done. When you have those frayed edges, sometimes you lose sight of what is vital important. If everything else fell away, this is what's vital to me. So it gives space and opportunity to work a way through some of the messiness of everyday life and refocus on this is what I'm committed to with my life. And I think for first responders too, who deal with a lot of trauma, that they are able to take a break and take a bird's eye view of the life that they've been given and also how they want to contribute to the lives of others, but keep space for healing and rejuvenation for themselves so that they can do that job well.
Mm-hmm. So I know that any project like this is never just the task of a few people. So who else has come on board alongside you and your family in terms of your vision for this project and fundraising and all of those types of things? Who else have you partnered with to make this whole thing possible?
I can't begin to name all the people. It's been a community thing. When we first started out, Al and I had this idea, or our family had the idea of doing it all on our own. And then more and more people came out of the woodwork, oh, this should be a community project, right? If you allow businesses to assist you, then you would have money left over for things. And so that's where the whole programming idea came in. So we've had, you know, concrete companies and construction companies and windows and doors and plumbing company. One plumbing company especially stood out, where they called us up and said, come to our showroom. And I've driven by their place quite often thinking, oh, someday when I'm rich and famous, then I can go shopping there. But when he called, it was like, well, I would love to come shopping in your showroom, but you have like Cadillac version of our Forward Focus. So, and he says, no, you have to come. So he met us at the door and says, whatever you need, like your showers, your tubs, your sinks, your toilets, your taps, everything, whatever you need, take it out of our showroom and it's our gift. And we had so many stories like that, that people came out of the woodwork and with construction material, with just words of support, prayer, newspapers and reporters. And then we did two big fundraisers last summer that were very successful with the help of a lot of people. We did an annual Hard Miles run, and it's a 5-kilometer run, and it involved a lot of first responders, and that was in June. We hope to do that again on June 15th. And we did a tractor parade on August 17th, and we hope to do that again. It's called Shifting Gears. And so, yeah, August 17th will be our tractor parade. And it also, just the community that it created was very encouraging for us. And from the response that we got from the participants, it also was meaningful for them to be in a group of people who experienced what other farmers and first responders experienced.
Diane, I know it's something we've talked about on the show before, but it's such a gift to give the community, to give them such a concrete way to help. You know, it's so hard, especially when you know that a family is facing a loss or a community is facing a loss, that, you know, everybody says, well, let me know how I can help. But it puts such a strain on the family, I think, to what you're just going to stand there and come up with random ideas of ways that people can help, and they can't fix it, you know, but to give the community the opportunity for a business to say, I can't fix the thing that set this all in motion, but I can give you sinks. You know, that's a very, I don't want to say an easy way for someone to help, because plumbing is expensive and sinks are expensive, but you know, a straightforward way to contribute. Yeah.
It's a concrete way. Yeah. Like the ability for people to show their support is a gift from them, but it's also, yeah, it's a way for people to show that they want to support a cause that they believe in.
It's very meaningful both sides.
I love too that your space sounds so not like a therapist's office or like a doctor's office, you know, because it's a lot of offices like that are, you know, those seafoam green vinyl chairs and some inspirational artwork. And that doesn't feel very comforting to me, at least, and I would imagine to a lot of people. And, you know, the space that you're creating sounds a lot more like visiting someone's home or a vacation cabin rather than going to the doctor. And that sounds a lot more enjoyable, to be perfectly honest. You know, it's...
Yeah. And it's definitely meant as a respite place, right? Like, we're not equipped, and we want to make sure we stress that with everyone, that we're not equipped to deal with crisis situations. But if we give people space to reflect on their life and on what they think is important, on their goals, then hopefully it gives them a good grounding opportunity and that they can live well. Ultimately, we want to prevent this tragedy from happening in other places. Like the year Dallas passed away, there was 7 farmers in Lambton County alone, in our county, that took their own life. And you don't hear of it anywhere, right? Like, it's not on the news. It's not, so no, there's not very many people who are aware of the statistics. And I guess ultimately we want to prevent this, but also the tragedy of living without joy or living without hope and goals and aspirations. And that's a lot more prevalent. I mean, 7 farmers is huge. But living without joy is probably an epidemic, right? And so if we give people this space to kind of regroup, we're hoping that will bring them joy and purpose, and so that we don't get to crisis mode.
You mentioned the statistics, and I took the ones that you have on your website that are really hard to read, that 25% of first responders think about suicide, and that farmers are twice as likely to die by suicide than the general population. I know that this has become, you know, part of your life. So what do you see as some of the contributing factors that are associated with both our first responders and our farmers being more likely to contemplate or actually to die by suicide?
I think it's good to start with the type of people that they both are. Generally speaking, both farming and first responders are the type of people who want to offer their help, who want to give of themselves, who want to serve in the community, who want to help the community, make a difference, but who don't necessarily, are not naturally inclined to make sure that they are filled up themselves before they can pour out into other people's lives. And then when they get run stuck, they don't know how to tap into resources that will, you know, fill them up. I think farming has a lot of challenges where there's a lot of things that are just out of our control, right? The prices get dictated at the wholesale end and at the retail end, and somehow you hope that in between there's a little bit left over to pay the bills. We don't have any control over the weather. We don't have any control over government bureaucracy or your bank requirements. And it can feel like everything is being downloaded on us. And these are the rules. You figure it out, but you better make it all work. And I think that's very stressful. It's very isolating as farmers, where there used to be, you know, in a chunk of land, there used to be 10 farmers who would meet at the back fence and have a quick chat. Now we don't see each other because we're all on way bigger fields or way bigger farms. The community that used to pull together at church or at the community halls or at the farmer dances or whatever, a lot of that seems to have fallen away. So there's a lot of isolation. And I think for first responders, it's just a lot of the trauma. The trauma that they can't process, that they don't aren't necessarily required to process, and the damage it does to their families. I feel almost ashamed that as a Canadian communities, we know how desperately the families, the marriages of our first responders are fighting for life. And we take their service very readily, you know, keep our community safe, but we don't backfill and don't give them the supports that they need to thrive in their personal lives. So I find that very tragic. And they deal with a lot of the trauma very alone. And that's also unraveling and very exhausting. So I think a lot of it is just mental fatigue that we hope to address.
I often wonder too about, I mean, I don't know the intricacies necessarily of how first responder services work, but you know, a lot of our rural places are covered by volunteer first responders. And I'm just going to assume that they don't have the same resources as their city counterparts. You know, these people are the first on the scene of some really tragic things. And then they turn around and go right back home and right back to work, right back to the farm. And it's not the same as if you're in a city fire department and you all go back to the fire hall together or go back to the police department or whatever. You know, that there probably isn't that time to decompress, or there isn't someone back there who's having those conversations about, you know, how you're feeling about what you just saw, or access to therapists or the kinds of support that are probably available to those bigger city fire departments that our rural volunteer firefighters just don't get.
I think it's a very good point. And also that the volunteer fire departments often deal with calls that involve people that they know very well, right? Their friends, neighbors, or a relative of someone. So there's that aspect. But I was amazed at, in speaking with fire chiefs and police chiefs of bigger cities, how they also say there is not the resources that everybody believes there is to be available for their members. And that they, you know, they would go 20 years without having a debrief session. And that really surprised me that in like some of our bigger cities, like London and you know, Cambridge, those were two of the ones that stick out in my head, that they also say we don't have the resources to offer our members to help them thrive.
So I know that it's difficult to talk about suicide prevention because none of us really know what's going on in other people's minds. But if a listener suspects that they have a friend or family member, they know of someone who they're worried about, who they feel like is in that mindset, are there things that we should do in that moment or at that time that might be able to help?
I think the biggest thing is the stigma, right? The more we talk about mental wellness as a very normal part of our overall wellness, and that we create the space that that normalizes caring for our mental health is our first and biggest step, because that will create the opportunity for us to have very normal conversation. Like you would say, you know, someone's got a headache for 3 months. Well, maybe you got to go to the doctor, or right, like that. It's just a normal thing to do, to seek out help. But there is room. I think that if we speak more about mental health and maybe have more knowledge about the symptoms, that we, with respect and with respect for boundaries, but that we intentionally step into the lives of other people who are suffering. I think we're very afraid of being the trigger, where maybe we should be more afraid of the outcomes the other way, right? So with love and respect to almost force yourself in, that's too hard, but to nudge yourself in, or kind of, you know, mold yourself into their life, creating that space where you can have the hard conversations. And I've noticing this, you know, last year you came out and came to all our birthday parties. We're noticing you're not doing that anymore. How can I help? Not do you need help, because they'll always say no. Or can we go to a therapist together, or I know a therapist, or can we work on this card together and we'll chat it through, right? Often, especially for men, if they have something to do, conversation comes easier than if let's put two chairs in your room and you sit on one chair and I sit on the other chair and we'll force this conversation. And I think having tangible resources, if someone had a Three Oaks card and said, I'm noticing this, here's something very tangible that you might be able to, you know, that might be beneficial to you. We do intend to give all our business cards and that to people like Farm Credit and like bank managers and feed salesmen and veterinarians who see the farmers on their difficult days and that they have the resources available to offer to them. But yeah, I think the being intentional and not afraid of mental health conversation is our biggest and most important step.
Yeah. I think especially around mental health, it's better to regret the thing you said than the thing you didn't say, right? If you don't ask the question, then they're thinking afterwards, why didn't I say that thing? I mean, it's easier to say something dumb and apologize than it is to not say the thing that might make a difference in someone's life. So, I mean, I think it's probably always better to put yourself out there if you think someone is struggling rather than to hold back and regret that you didn't have that hard conversation.
Yeah, and it probably depends how we frame it, right? But hopefully with the right choice of words, we can always convey to them, I might be out of line, but it comes, you know, because I care. And so I would like to say this to you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, like you said, if it's coming from a place of respect and love, then hopefully they understand that where we're coming from too, even if it's misplaced or if we're off base, then, you know, maybe we can laugh about it later. But yeah.
Diane, I love to, as someone who's married to a feed salesman, the idea of putting your business cards out into that, the hands of folks who just see farmers and see, you know, our rural first responders. Because, you know, I mean, presumably if a farmer falls and breaks their leg, you know, they know where the hospital is. They know how to call their doctor. They know, yeah, it's pretty straightforward. But for folks who don't have the experience with finding a mental health provider or who are encountering stigma about, you know, seeking mental health help, I think folks can be really confused about where to start. You know, there can be a lot of, it's hard work to find a therapist, even if you know where to find a therapist, you know, even if you've got recommendations, it's still a hard thing to do, you know, and I can only imagine that if you're don't have any background in finding a provider, that it's got to be, you know, that much more.
Yeah, and having that information come from someone that you trust and already have a relationship with and who isn't being judgmental about it, just saying that this is a thing that's out there, that goes a long way too, to have someone that you already know and you trust their expertise in another part of their job, that then coming from them would mean a lot as well.
Yeah, you already have that trust and that respect, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I think too, having these people who are already out there interacting with farmers and making use of that resource rather than, I don't know what your other option would be, to like hire a social worker to just drive around to farms and hand out cards to people. Like that does not, I can't speak for Canadians obviously, but that would not go over terrifically successfully in our area, I don't think. You know, where the vet's already out there. You know, the feed salesman's already out there, like, you know, and I think they do have that level of trust usually.
Yeah. And they see him on the days when they might need the most, or at least be ready to receive help the most. And I think one of the things that we have been led to do is when guests come to the cabin, they will have be encouraged to do all the self-directed programming. Like reflection exercises and to go for a walk in the woodlot and that sort of thing. But when they go home, they do receive a follow-up call from our partners at the National Farmers Mental Health Alliance. And the purpose of that is to create that conversation without the farmer having to pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm so-and-so. And I'm, you know, in my opinion, I'm the weakling that needs help. So if a therapist just touches base after they've been at the cabin, it's just part of the protocol. It's much easier to swallow, and hopefully it takes away one more hurdle for people to receive help. Because after that conversation, it's like, okay, do you want to touch base again in 2 weeks? Or, you know, do you feel you're in a good spot? So I think it just creates that opportunity to receive help without the intimidation factor.
That's a really good point. So you talked at the very beginning about growing hope. So what gives you the most hope when you think about Three Oaks and the discussions that are coming out of your cabin and the discussions that we're having around mental health these days in agriculture?
I guess hope in the seasons, hope in like farming seasons, but also hope in seasons of life. It's easy to let, I think our natural inclination is to let tragedy or negative things in our life, disappointing things in our life, define us. And when we make an active effort to say, no, that's not who we are, right? If my terrible season on the farm does not define me, the fact that I lost this patient en route to the hospital doesn't define me. My character, my integrity, my contribution is what defines me. I think that's how we grow hope. And very early on, when we were blindsided, and I can't stress that enough, our family, like we described Dallas as the funny guy, the go-to guy, we all knew he was stressed, but we wrote it off to the regular stress that every young farmer, certainly one who's expanding his business, they're all encountering that kind of stress. We were blindsided. But very soon afterward, we as a family sat together and said, this cannot be who we are. We have to move forward, not on, because he's always with us, but we're moving forward with a hope in different direction, where we had hope of, you know, a intergenerational farm or a multi-generational farm. Now our hope will be the ripple effect that we send out from Three Oaks, hopefully into many farming and first responder communities, that what defines us is who we are as a person, and what happens to us is not who we are as a person.
I think sometimes in agriculture, we can get really caught up in that the farm and the person being so intertwined. And I think it is really important for all of us to remember that we are individuals and we are our own selves. And yes, the farm is important and the legacy is important and all of that stuff. But when it comes right down to it, you are more important than the farm. So no matter how much, you know, all of those other things are of value to you, if you're not okay, then that's what you need to focus on. And the farm can't come first in those situations. You have to take care of yourself. So I hope that if there's anyone in that place, or if you know of someone in that place, just remember that you are more important than the farm.
And the farm can't thrive if you're not doing well.
That's right. And if things have to change and the farm is not what you thought it was going to be, or what your parents thought it was going to be, or your grandparents, or any of those things, some of that intergenerational stuff can put pressure on your shoulders that you don't, you know, that we think we have to take on. But yeah, you as an individual is what matters the most. So yeah, that's a lot of heavy stuff today, Katie. Do you want to ask our usual wrap-up question, or do you have anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I guess. Not really. Diane, if people would like to donate or contribute to Three Oaks Cabin. I imagine they can find that information on your website.
Yeah, on our website, there's opportunity to donate in a few ways. There's e-transfer and also Canada Helps. And through Canada Helps, they get their tax receipt immediately afterward. So that's a very easy and clean way to donate. We always welcome, of course, donations. Whatever money is donated now will go directly towards programming and free therapy for our guests. And honestly, the sky is the limit. We've had a lot of questions about, would you consider building another one, you know, in a different county somewhere? Right now, we would love to just enjoy this one for a little bit.
Since you haven't even opened the doors yet, give yourselves a couple of weeks to think about it, right?
Yeah, but the sky is the limit. And I think that's where hope is such a beautiful thing, right? It has no limits. So if we can have a community that can get together and say, let's build one in Huron County or in Ottawa Valley or somewhere else, in time, we'd be all over it. So yeah, donations will be put directly towards assisting fellow farmers and first responders.
All right. Well, then we will take a hard right into our normal last question here. It feels a little out of left field, I guess. So we ask all of our guests, if you were going to dominate a category at the county fair, what would it be? And categories can be real or made up to ensure that you win.
You know, when I read that, I thought, I don't know, I don't think of myself as being good at anything. I can get a lot of stuff done. But it might be tenacity. If there was a category for tenacity, I might do that.
I think even just based on our discussion today, I'm ready to give you the ribbon.
to not give up.
Well, I wouldn't want to fight her for it, Arlene.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
She's going to win. So.
That's right. So we always have a little cussing and discussing segment at the end of our interviews, and listeners can submit theirs on our SpeakPipe or through email. So check the show notes for the links to those. So you can either leave us a voice memo that we'll play, or Katie and I will read out your cussing and discussing. Katie, do you have anything you want to cuss and discuss this week and or discuss?
I do. I feel like we're, and this is with fully acknowledging how much trash is on YouTube. And even on presumably broadcast TV, although we don't have it, but there's a lot of junk on screens. But I think this idea that any and all screen time for children is basically the worst is tremendously misleading. Both of my kids are obsessed with Kratz Creatures, which I remember watching when I was in high school, you know, babysitting. And so almost 30 years, it's still on the air. They're Canadian, too. But this morning, my daughter asked why we feed. I give trimmings from the apple trees to the guinea pigs. And she asked why. And I said, well, their teeth keep growing. And she said, oh, like beavers and rabbits. And I said, where'd you learn that? She goes, TV. So obviously there is really valuable content out there if we wade through enough Minecraft videos to find it.
That's true. And the thing too is, I mean, yes, also lots of garbage on YouTube, but there's also such specialized content that if our kids really love a thing, like, they can really dive into it. Whereas when we were kids, it was, you got whatever was on TV on a Saturday morning or whatever. And then, you know, like, I remember watching probably way more sports than I ever cared about because that was what was on sometimes on the couple of channels that we had. But if your kid is really into tractors or, you know, like farming or pigs or whatever, you know, like, they can find so much cool stuff and learn a ton. I mean, obviously, yeah, screen limits, blah, blah, blah. But there's value too in learning and being able to absorb lots of cool things about things that you're into for kids and grownups.
And there's a lot to be said for entertainment value, too. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, yeah, that as well. Yeah.
But when you have that five-year-old who deeply needs to see a video of a theoretical battle between a giant squid and a sperm whale over and over and over, YouTube is your best friend.
Yeah,
and that's true. Learned a lot from it, I think. So, you know. Diane, what would you like to cuss? Oh, go ahead.
I think just going back to that, to have that half an hour of downtime for those really busy minds.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, we have to limit screen time. But yeah, I think that you're absolutely right to have a little bit of time built in there. As long as it's not garbage, then...
Yeah, we don't need to write anything off. Probably generations ago, they were saying that the radio was going to rot everyone's minds. And yeah, everyone turned out okay.
And that's where podcasts came from. So you're welcome.
That's right. Yeah. There's no such thing as too much podcast time.
Absolutely not.
Don't worry, listeners. You're good.
Everyone should be listening to more podcasts. Diane, what would you like to cuss and discuss today?
I think it's more discussing. Just that we can hopefully reinvent or rebuild some of our intimate agricultural communities, right? Like our, especially after COVID, that if we are intentional about reaching out to our neighbors, checking in on them, and building some of those communities. Al and I have started doing a dessert social, a midwinter dessert social. We have a little Facebook group from our community, and I run off some flyers, throw them in the mailboxes, and it was incredible the turnout we had. It was just bring a dessert if you want to. You don't have to bring a dessert, just to see your neighbors and have a discussion with them and have the opportunity to ask, how's life? How are you? So I think, I don't know, after COVID, I think it's really important that, especially in our rural communities where we don't necessarily have the resources that our urban friends do, that we're intentional about checking in on each other.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I know last year we ended up, we had a barn party in January. It was the week after Christmas, and the kids had that full week after Christmas off. And so the first weekend in January, we had a party in the barn, and it started out with, you know, we'll invite a handful of neighbors, and then it expanded because you're already getting ready. And so we had so much fun last year. We did it again this year. And I think we had like around 200 people showed up, and it was just drop in whenever you want. Some people brought food, some people didn't. And it was so nice. And it, you know, like it felt like, yeah, we were getting something back because there were lots of events that had gotten canceled, and, you know, the volunteer group that ran this or that had decided they weren't going to do it anymore, or, you know, that group had gotten older and no one had taken their place. And there's something about the momentum of when something happens every year, it's just that expectation that you do it, but that can kind of fall off the wayside, and sometimes it's hard to get things back. But yeah, just making a point to reach out to people is really important. And a party every once in a while that includes dessert is always good too.
Arlene, what do you have to cuss and discuss?
So for a while there, I always had notes about what I was going to cuss and discuss. And then today I was like, well, I'll just see what comes up for me. So mine is more of a discussion too. And I just want to give a shout out to, based on some of the stuff we talked about today, to all of our volunteer fire departments. Wherever you live, if you're a farmer, you probably are covered by a place where there might be one or maybe two, you know, full-time firefighters. But most of the people that are going to respond if there's an emergency are people who are training on their nights off and are, you know, carrying around pagers or whatever services they use now to let each other know that there's an emergency. But those people are ready to respond at a moment's notice whenever something goes wrong. And I just, the people who have the capacity and the heart to do that job, that means so much to the rest of us. And I think that they deserve lots of credit and admiration for the work that they're doing. And I hope that they also have the opportunity to reach out for support when they need it. So yay, volunteer firefighters. Thank you.
I'd like to add to that, Arlene, I assume that in Canada, volunteer fire departments do a lot of fundraisers, I would imagine, like they do here.
I imagine they probably do, yes. Yeah, they have fish fries and all that kind of stuff.
If you can afford to support your local fire departments or as many fire departments as you can, I certainly encourage people to do that, because if it's your house that's on fire, or hopefully even if it's your neighbor's house that's on fire, you want them to be well trained and to have all the equipment they need and to be well supported. And none of that stuff is cheap.
Yes. Yeah. That's an added bonus as well.
And you don't have to cook on that day. So that's another win.
Yeah. Do you guys get that? Like, does every fire department have a pancake breakfast in the spring where you guys are?
We have one every month, actually.
Dang. I'm coming to Diane's house. Dessert, socials, coffee, and a monthly pancake breakfast. That sounds amazing.
Please do. Okay.
Yeah. Signing up. So thank you so much, Diane, for joining us today. So like we already said, if people want to find out more about Three Oaks Cabin, they can look at it. Is that the website, Three Oaks Cabin, or what's the actual? Yeah, that is it. So it's here in Ontario. Is it accessible to anyone in Ontario or certain regions? Or if someone, if they know of someone, or if they themselves feel like they need a break, who can actually go?
Any farmer from really across the world, but I suspect it will be limited to North America for sure.
Sure. Yeah. But there aren't actually geographic restrictions. If you can get there, you can stay.
And we just want to encourage everybody, if you know someone, you know, pass along the information. And yeah, all the information is available on our website.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. It was great talking to you. And thank you for sharing about your family and about Dallas more specifically.
Thank you. It was great to have this opportunity to have a very, I guess, casual sort of discussion, and much appreciate the opportunity and the exposure it will give to the cabin so that it in turn can help them.
Thank you so much.
Have a beautiful day.
Thanks for joining us, Diane. Thank you for joining us on Barnyard Language. If you enjoy the show, we encourage you to support us by becoming a patron. Go to www.patreon.com/barnyardlanguage to make a small monthly donation to help cover the costs of making the show.
Please rate and review the podcast and follow the show so you never miss an episode.
You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Barnyard Language, and on Twitter we are Barnyard Pod. If you want to connect with other farming families, you can join our private Barnyard Language Facebook group.
We are always in search of guests for the podcast. If you or someone you know would like to chat with us, please get in touch.